Oz thought of the days of the dying Earth, when pyramids would wander for water. But she thought, too, of this age, of the paranoiacs who believed in the imminence of the New World Order, a world government as enslavers of mankind. Two bullet wounds on his chest, another through his neck. She couldn't find the fourth. Jared Betak's blood filled the foam bed cushion. His eyes were half closed. The West Virginia State Medical Examiner would perform a forensic autopsy on him, and Moss wondered if they would find evidence of the thyroid cancer that would have otherwise taken his life. Jared Betak is Nicole Nyong'o's husband.
"She's gone," said Brock. "I sent a team to her apartment, on your request. She hasn't shown up to work either."
"Gone," said Moss, remembering Nicole's eyes glassy, her Manhattan, the smoke of two parliaments rising to the ceiling. But then, she might appear before too long. Nicole had continued working at the Donnell House in her IF, had become a regular at the Mayor's Inn. But the chemical weapons hadn't been discovered in that timeline. Who knows what that would change? "All right, keep looking for her," said Moss, fearing how radically the future might already have changed from her experience of it. "We need to find her."
"Come over here," said Brock. "I want you to take a look at these."
They wore blue nitrile gloves to study the sheaves of documents Brock had recovered from an unlocked safe in the front of the Winnebago. They sat together at the dinette table, Brock spreading out maps and sets of blueprints. The red line of the D.C. Metro, the Capitol building, detailed notes on the Senate chamber.
"And this,"
said Brock, unrolling schematics of NSC launch pads in Kodiak, Alaska. There were others. The Air Force Space Division headquarters in Colorado Springs, the Naval Space Command headquarters in Dahlgren. There was information about Cape Canaveral, the military floor at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. Maps of their ventilation systems, security profiles. Brock showed her similar information about the United Nations General Assembly in New York, but it was the blueprints of the FBI CGIS facility that chilled her. On some level, she knew. On some level, throughout the hours of waiting here, as rumors stirred about what had been discovered in the barn, the contiguous pieces of her investigation started to meld. Moss absorbed the rich irony of Brock's having discovered these plans, that he was preventing the attack on CGIS that one day would have destroyed his wife and daughters. "They're a terrorist militia," said Moss. "Ex-military."
"And these are the targets?"
asked Brock. "Yes," she said. "Or potential targets." These other locations hadn't been attacked in the IF she'd traveled to. But she wondered if other ifs would have played out differently. She wondered about the cataclysms that might have been, or still might be. The enormity of her mistake rushed into her like water rushing into a gap. She had hurried to this house, heartbroken at the doubling of Buchanan, hurried here in a mania to try to save the girl. But she shouldn't have. She should have been methodical. Should have called O'Connor. Should have waited. Jared Betak had been here. Cobb had been here. Who else would they have found if she'd waited? Now Betak was dead, and Cobb and Miss Ashley had scattered, seeds to the wind. She had lost touch with the greater mission.
"White supremacists?"
asked Brock.
"The Nazi paraphernalia in the bedroom here."
"No, I don't think so. Not primarily," said Moss, trying to recover, to see past those missed chances. "Anti-government for certain. Carl Heildkruger. He acquired blueprints for sieges 2 years ago, sold by a member of the Mountaineer Militia shortly before your people arrested him."
"We'll try to track these chemicals. Try to track the sale of the equipment," said Brock. "I'll run Heildkruger's name by our domestic terror people. See what they can come up with. We've learned a lot since McVeigh."
Moss remembered the name of the sieges suicide bomber, memorized from books that would never be written. Ryan Wrigley Torgerson. He worked at sieges, would have reported to work with explosives sewn into his body. There were constitutional protections against pre-crime, Fourth Amendment applications that complicated NCIS investigations. She would have to talk with O'Connor, apply for special warrants through the military courts to arrest this individual. "Alert your colleagues at CGIS immediately," said Moss. "I think the discovery of these blueprints is enough to suggest you search the ventilation system and the fire suppression system. I doubt you'll find anything, but they should increase security. They should consider CGIS an active target. There is an individual to consider a person of interest, a potential bomber. He's an FBI employee. Ryan Wrigley Torgerson."
"Torgerson? I know him," said Brock. "I've met him. He works in my wife's department at CGIS." "Are you sure?" "He's meek, Shannon." "Torgerson. I'll ask for surveillance, see what we can dig up about him."
The National Guard allowed access to the barn much later that afternoon. They had rendered safe the recovered chemicals, had eliminated the threat of explosives. The medical examiner of Upshur County had been waiting on site since the bodies were first discovered. He was a young man, a skinny doctor who wore a shirt and tie, and a cowboy hat the color of calfskin that he removed and held reverently as he approached the barn doors. He'd been told there were a number of bodies, and he'd brought three men with him. Older men, who seemed more like ranch hands than medical techs. They wore protective suits, a precaution against chemicals that might still be trapped in the victim's hair or might escape from the cavities of their bodies. Moss stood at a distance, examining the rider. A hole had been drilled through the passenger side of the cargo space, and a rubber tube dangled from the hole. A mobile gas chamber. The barn itself was equipped with a ventilation system and safety showers, protective suits and lockers. Moss imagined Jared Bitak and Charles Cobb in these yellow suits dispersing poison gas or acid or disease into the back of the truck, measuring their victim's suffering. They would have moved Marion from the basement in the middle of the night, the barn floodlight disconnected, the house lights off. She would have been bound, gagged, and no one would have heard her anyway. Not out here. A favorable wind might have carried her screams, but only so far. "This is how my life will end," Marion would have thought. In the back of a Ryder truck, gagging on the stink of the previous dead. She might have realized she smelled her own death. She might have scratched at the walls of the truck. She might have been senseless with terror. Moss imagined Marion weeping for mercy. She would have heard the purring of an engine, or the whir of a box van pushing gas through the rubber hose. Marion's photograph had anchored Moss to terra firma those nights when she felt adrift in her if. "Life is greater than time," she had written. A false hope. The Upshur ME and his men wearing hazmat suits laid out plastic sheets, gingerly removed each body from the truck. 4 males, 2 females, one of them Marion. All were naked, all significantly damaged by chemical or acid burns, most of the bodies bloated and glossy, facial features distorted or altogether missing. Some of the bodies fell apart like jelly in their hands. KDKA News. Marion's picture cycling with helicopter shots of the house and barn. Maps of Buchanan. Interviews with neighbors. Sound bites from Brock. Mugshots of Ashley Bitak and the man she had fled with, Richard Harrier, captured hiding beneath the front porch of a property 3 miles down 151. Harrier, a Home Depot cashier. Shots of the Home Depot in Bridgeport. Blanket coverage of sarin gas, reprising coverage of the Om Shinrikyo subway attacks of Oklahoma City. And soon the house on Cricketwood Court had become a shrine to the slain family. At first just a few bouquets wrapped in green tissue and cellophane, pops of color left on the front stoop. But within a few days the stoop was mounded with flowers, framed photographs, white crosses. Moss sat in her truck and watched as people arrived and departed from the makeshift memorial. Remorseful that no memorial like this had been made for Courtney. A personal regret that she had never laid flowers here. Later that evening, Moss returned and added her own bouquet. A burst of roses. She worked the phones late that afternoon, tracking down the owners of the apple orchard where Miss Ashley had lived years from now, where she had hosted the memorial for Jared Bitak, Moss remembered Nicole mentioning that the place used to be owned by ceramicists, and soon found that the property was still owned by Ned and Mary Stent, the proprietors of the Pot and Kettle. She tracked Ned Stent to an art fair in Atlanta, Ned speaking with her from his hotel room, explaining the differences between earthenware and Raku, describing the ceramics classes they offered at their orchard, the dimensions of their kiln. No, they'd never met anyone named Ashley Betak, had never met Jared Betak. And no, they weren't planning on selling their property.
Not for a few years as of yet, at least.
There was no viewing of the Mersault family's bodies, though their five caskets were established in separate rooms of the Salandra Funeral Home on West Pike, for a gathering of friends and family before the funeral mass across the street at St. Patrick's. So many children had come to grieve. High school and middle school children in their nice clothes, their church clothes, outfits that would double as Easter clothes in the next few weeks. Posters covered with the Mersault family's pictures leaned on easels next to their caskets. Moss touched the lacquered wood of Marion's coffin. She stood with her head bowed, falsifying prayer for the sake of the other mourners in line to pay their respects. At the funeral mass, Moss sat alone in the back pew while the priest blessed each of the five caskets, as the faithful took communion and prayed. St. Patrick's was Moss's childhood church. She'd been raised Catholic, had memories of Sunday school here, remembered her communion dress, the taste of the Eucharist. St. Pat's wasn't a stone colossus like the older churches of Pittsburgh, but rather a contemporary remodel, with ochre walls and cobalt trim, stained glass windows of pink, green, and yellow squares. The altarpiece was a brash design of crimson and gold diamonds. The sculpture of the crucifixion above the altar held Moss's attention through the service, a crucifix bathed in color cast by the sunlit stained glass. Christ seemed to levitate above the altar, as if the arms of the cross were wings. If it weren't for the pins at his ankles and wrists, she imagined he might simply float away. Suffocating, the agonized sound of children crying, the unbearable sorrow. Moss left the service before it had concluded, a familiar release, she remembered, escaping church. News vans had set up across the street, parked where they could capture establishing shots of the funeral home, the church, probably hoping for shots of children leaving in tears. Chilly air, but warm in the sun. She walked West Pike to clear her head. She crossed the tracks and the busier intersection at Morganza. The parking lot of the Pizza Hut was full, families eating lunch together. A ridiculous place to mourn, between the blue dumpsters. But this is where Courtney had died. This is where Moss had found her friend's body. One of the dumpsters had been replaced in the past several years, but the other looked like it could have been left over from 1985, nearly 12 years ago. Moss leaned against the brick wall, remembering. And she cried for Courtney, for Marion, for Marion's family, for her own. She remembered her father in dim flashes, how he would lift her from bed, how he would lift her and spin, wintergreen on his breath and pipe smoke in his hair. She cried for every lost thing. Everything gone. Chartier's Creek ran behind the Pizza Hut. A narrow trickle of water bounded on either side by weeds. Moss sat on the bench of a picnic table that the Pizza Hut kids used on their smoke breaks. She watched the murky water. Trash littered the muddy banks. Peaceful, in its way. She felt removed from Cannonsburg. The noise of traffic just a background of white noise. Sunlight hit the water like a speckle of silver fire. Glorious. But Moss resented the thought. This place wasn't beautiful. It was the end of everything. Her cell phone rang, the sound startling her. She let it ring. A few moments of silence before it started ringing again. She checked the number. Brock.
Hello? She said.
Moss,
he said, his voice cracking with enthusiasm, ecstatic.
Moss, is that you?
I was at their funeral, she said. Marion and
Shannon, I have wonderful news.
he said, overcome by emotion, ebullient.
I don't understand this or how it happened, Shannon, but I have truly wonderful news. We found her.
Moss didn't answer, only tried to puzzle out his meaning. We found her. Trees grew like a canopy over the water. Their leaves dappled the muddy banks and swept into the creek. She watched the leaves clot in an eddy before disappearing beneath the shadows of a corrugated steel tube that took the creek underground.
We found her, said Brock. She's alive. We found her in the woods, but she's alive, Shannon. We found her.
Who? Said Moss.
Marion, said Brock. We found her. Marion's alive, Shannon. She's alive.
3. A mistake, Moss's first thought. A misidentification. But she had seen the body. Had seen Marion in the back of the Ryder truck. The girl's aunt and uncle had identified her. Had traveled from Ohio to the office of the chief medical examiner in Charleston to view the remains. Marion's aunt had stomached a fuller study. Had inspected the cadaver and spotted the dimple scar on her interior left knee. A gymnastics injury. And the scar from her removed appendix. Without a doubt, her sister's child. Brock must have found some other 17-year-old, a similar but different girl. Marion, Brock had said. She's alive. A fuller search of the forest near the Black Waterfalls, where his men had spotted the Cairns. They had fanned out through the forest at dawn, searching for other Cairns, to figure out what the Cairns might mark, when one of his men shouted. A frail body, pale and bluish, hair the color of the soil. Clothes stiff with frost, no shoes. She was found in the channel of a dried-up creek. Her skin was wet, her hair was damp and frozen. A resemblance to Marion, Brock had thought. Brock put his palm to her neck, and the skin was cold. But he felt her pulse. What would have happened had Brock never found her? Moss wondered. She would have died, she thought. She would have been in the forest for years, her body in that dried-up creek, decomposing, until men digging for ginseng spotted red berries and started to dig.
She's traumatized, said Brock,
as Moss was shown into Preston Memorial's boardroom. Unadorned walls, a blonde wood conference table. He chewed his licorice, pulverizing the gum.
Talk me through this, said Moss.
Either we buried the wrong girl or we're making a mistake now, he said. I was staggered by the resemblance. I thought that maybe I was deceiving myself. I thought she must be someone else, but she told me her name.
She's conscious? Asked Moss.
She's weak.
Who else knows about her? Moss asked.
Lockwood, the CEO here, said Brock. A small team providing care. Nurses, Dr. Schroeder, my men, there were 6 of us. My supervisor. They know we found a young woman.
You haven't called her relatives?
No.
And you talked with Marion? She asked.
Shannon? She's identical. She's the same. But nothing makes sense, said Brock. She says they killed the wrong person. She's terrified. The remains we found? They were marred by chemicals. When her aunt identified the body, she was expecting Marion. And so maybe she convinced herself that body was Marion. I think we should test this girl. Compare DNA with the corpse.
Echoing, Moss thought. Someone would have had to travel to an F. Would have had to find a future Marion and bring her here to Terra Firma. That didn't seem likely, but it was the only way she knew. What does she say happened? She asked.
Fleece is the one who took her, said Brock. Elric Fleece picked her up from the Kmart. She knew him.
The name withered in Moss's ear. Fleece. A sailor on Libra. The suicide in the mirrored room. Marion had known him. A friend of her father's. Has anyone told Marion about her family?
She knows,
said Brock.
She's been watching TV.
Preston Memorial's shift supervisor, Dr. Schroeder, was heavily made up,
her hair a silver sweep. An elegant woman who spoke with a southern softness, her heels clacking like a quick-tempo metronome. Cold and wet, she says she swam through a river. Extreme hypothermia when we brought her in. I'll be honest, I wasn't very hopeful. But she's doing well now, all things considered. Her feet worry me. The flesh was severely damaged. The poor thing didn't have any shoes. And it's been cold these past few nights. She hasn't been able to walk much without pain, though she can make it to the bathroom and back. Moss's breath caught. Will she keep her feet? We're not out of the woods, said Dr. Schroeder. No gangrene, though. She's responding very well. Whatever happened to her out there? She hasn't gone into much detail, which is common with people who've been through trauma. She's very confused, I think. Hypothermia can affect memory, so you'll have to be patient with her. Brock had posted sentries outside Marion's room. Someone from the hospital security staff and an FBI agent whose face Moss recognized from the other night in Buchanan. They nodded a greeting to each other. She should be awake, said Dr. Schroeder. Her core temperature was low, so she's been sluggish. I'd like to speak with her alone, said Moss. Can I find you once we've had a chance to talk a little? Yes, of course, said Dr. Schroeder. I'll check back with your colleague or I'll be in my office. Let me know if you need anything. And, of course, there's a call button on her bed if you need something from the nurse on duty. Moss heard the television from within the room. A laugh track. Anxious to meet this young woman, Moss knocked. Come in. Marion was sitting up in bed. She looked comfortable despite the tubes threading her arms to IV drips and the oxygen tube lacing her nostrils, the splay of wires monitoring her vitals. She was awake, but wan, exhausted. Her hair was pulled back, accenting the oval cast of her face. Although Moss knew of echoes, she had rarely been in their company. She had thought of echoes as duplicates. But that wasn't true, she realized now. This young woman was Marion Rissalt. Marion turned toward Moss. What's wrong with me? Everyone stares when they come in. Bandages wrapped her wrists. From the exposure? Moss wondered. Or a suicide attempt? No one had mentioned anything. Seinfeld was on the ceiling-mounted television. Nothing's wrong with you, said Moss, aware of emoting the same scrabble of uncertainty that annoyed her so often when people first noticed her prosthesis. Are you Marion? She asked, guilty again of pretending nothing was wrong. I'm Shannon. I'm with an agency called the Naval Criminal Investigative Service. Can I talk with you about what's happened? I don't remember everything, said Marion. That's understandable, said Moss. Do you mind if I have a seat? There was only one chair, already beside the bed. The heart monitor's sonorous tones and the hushed sounds of machines Moss didn't recognize made the room feel fragile. She had been at Marion's funeral earlier that morning, had watched a priest bless her closed casket with holy water. I know you've already told your story to some others, said Moss. My colleague, William Brock. You might be wondering why we don't just talk to each other, why I'm going to ask you to tell me what you've already told him. Moss noticed that Marion was shaking. Cold? Terror at her memories? Are you all right? She asked. I don't know, said Marion. Moss used the call button, and a moment later a nurse checked on her, helped lift Marion's blankets to her shoulders without disturbing her tubes or wires. Marion asked for a cup of tea, and the nurse returned with a plastic pot of hot water and a few Lipton tea bags. I'm all right, and I understand, said Marion. I don't think that man, Brock, I don't think he believed me. So, you want to hear for yourself, right? It's not a question of believing you, said Moss. But I'd like to hear from you. I don't want to hear your story from someone else. I saw myself. Did he tell you that? I saw myself out in the woods, said Marion. I think they wanted to kill me, but they killed her instead. A surprising sense of recognition.
I saw myself out in the woods. Sideways winding snow, the woman in the orange spacesuit reaching to her.
I believe you, said Moss. Tell me everything.
How did you get out there?
My dad has a friend. This guy named Fleece, said Marion. A war buddy. Dad took care of him. Like, he couldn't take care of himself. There was something wrong with him. He was... I think his brain was injured. They went riding together. Motorcycles. He met me after my shift. Told me I was supposed to go with him. That something had happened to my family.
Why didn't you drive? Asked Moss. You left your car in the parking lot.
He told me something terrible happened. Said I shouldn't be driving when I found out. I was so scared.
A hitch in her breath. Moss took the girl's hand in hers. It's all right if you need to cry, she said. Take a minute. It's all right.
Did he kill my mom? Is my family dead? Is that true? Why?
Moss held her hand. I'm so sorry, she said. I don't know why this happened. I want to find out why. She wanted to comfort Marion, but knew Marion would never truly recover from these deaths. Tell me about Fleece. Where did he take you?
He wouldn't tell me what happened. He said he was taking me home, said Marion. But he was going a different way. And when I asked him where he was taking me, he pulled over, tied my wrists. He put me in the back of his truck.
He tied you up back there.
Tied my wrists with twine, she said. I was gagged. I can't... This is... Things don't make sense.
I believe you, said Moss. I need to hear what happened to you.
That man from the FBI, who was here before you, he didn't believe me. He kept trying to catch me in a lie, asking me all sorts of questions. The same questions again and again, but I'm not lying. I swear to you. I swear to God I'm not lying. I'm just confused.
Marion, where did Fleece take you?
There was a place my dad used to take me to, said Marion. Family vacations. But back when my sister and brother were too small. My dad just took me. He called it our Vardager. Just some made-up word, I guess. Like, never-never land.
Vardager, said Moss. Where's the Vardager?
I was just a kid. I don't know. We were in the woods, but there was this lodge where he'd meet with his friends. Sometimes their families, too. Pine trees that Dad called hemlocks. There was a river. He liked to fish. A waterfall. All sorts of caves, crevices in the rocks I could squeeze into and hide out.
Was it the Blackwater Lodge? Asked Moss.
I think so, maybe, said Marion. He hasn't taken us for years, though. We'd go there, and I loved it because sometimes I thought that the mirror in the lodge would come to life. Sometimes I'd see myself at the river in the woods and think it was the mirror girl. My reflection, following me. You know, like Peter Pan in his shadow. I only saw the mirror girl a few times, standing across the river. My dad told me she wasn't real, that she was just my imaginary friend, just a daydream because I was a bored kid with no friends around.
And that's where Fleece took you? Asked Moss. To that lodge?
Not that lodge, but it was the same place. Those woods, said Marion. I don't know how long we drove. The ride rattled me and I got hurt. It seemed like forever, but when we stopped and he opened the rear door, I could see it was still dark and still a long way off from morning. Police pulled me from the truck, pushed me deeper into the woods. He said, I'm sorry, over and over, telling me that He wanted to keep me safe, but that it was too late and he had to do what they told him to do. He said my family would be dead in a day, but he didn't want me to die, so we should just do what they say.
Who? Asked Moss.
I don't know. Voices? Said Marion. He was scared. I could tell he was terrified of something. And then he threw me to the ground, all of a sudden, and that's when I recognized where I was. He'd taken me to the Vardagr.
How could you tell? Asked Moss. This was the middle of the night, out in the woods.
Because there's a tree that marks the Vardagr. This old dead tree that looks like a skeleton. It's all white, with no leaves. The Vardagr tree. And I heard the river I remembered as a kid, right there past the tree.
The Vardagr tree. Moss knew the tree. When she was lost in the woods, Moss had seen the tree repeating. Fleece's tree, the tree of bones in the mirrored room. Marion's father called it the Vardagr. Patrick Mersault had known this place.
I said to him, Christ have mercy on your soul. And he told me he was going to show me the end of time, said Marion. I was scared of him and didn't know what he was talking about. He told me that things were knotted up all around us.
A place near the Red Run? Asked Moss. A river. A clearing surrounded by pines.
He took me past the Vardagr tree, and we stepped out into that clearing. Saw the river in front of us. We were in some other place in the woods. There were other trees. Other Vardagr trees. A lot of them. In a line. He was pulling me along. We crossed the river over a fallen tree, and the weather turned to ice. That can't be real, can it? On the far side, our feet sank into the mud, and the sky was ridged, like I was looking at the roof of a mouth. And we saw ourselves reflected outward, like I was looking at myself through a kaleidoscope. Over and over and over, all around me. I couldn't look anymore and started to pray. But he said he wanted to show me God. And he lifted my head to the sky. I thought I saw Jesus on the cross appearing over the river. But the cross was upside down. And his mouth was bloody and... Oh, God. Oh, my God. The body had no skin.
Moss wanted to scream. But for Marion's sake, she crossed the room to collect herself. She looked out the window but saw her reflection in the glass. Marion had seen the terminus. She had seen the hanged men.
Please told me he had to tie me up again, said Marion. He took me back to the Vardagr tree and pushed me down. He pushed me against the tree and tied my wrists around the trunk. He said that someone would come for me. To take me somewhere else. I asked him where they would take me, but he said he didn't know, that he wasn't allowed to know. He said, I'm damaged, so I'm not allowed to know. And then he just left me there, out in the middle of the woods. It was so quiet. Everything was silence.
How long were you out there, tied up like that? Asked Moss.
I don't know, said Marion. Not long. Not even an hour. When I knew he was gone, I pulled at the twine and felt it give a little at my wrists, like it had a little play. It took me a while, but I was able to pull my hands free.
She held up her wrists, showed the bandages.
Bloodied myself up pretty bad, she said.
But you were free. Said Moss.
Yeah,
said Marion.
I was freezing. My hair and clothes were wet because it had rained. I didn't know where I was, but I remembered the lodge my dad used to take me to. Figured it must be close. I thought I could find it.
You knew where you were?
I thought I was on the wrong side of the river from the lodge. I couldn't find that tree we'd used to cross the river. But I knew I could wade across... Or swim if it was too deep. So I stepped in. said Marion. It felt like ice. The water was so cold, and there were rapids there. The water came up to my neck, but I could walk. I lost my footing, and it swept me down. But I came to the far side and crawled out. I'd never been so cold. I crossed this little meadow. I couldn't even feel my toes in the mud because I was so numb.
You're lucky you didn't die, said Moss.
I could hardly walk because I couldn't feel where my feet were beneath me. But everything still seemed the same, like I had wandered in a big circle. Then I realized that I'd somehow come back to where I'd started from, still on the wrong side of the river. I came to softer mud that had been chewed up by truck tires. From Fleece's truck, I thought. I could see where the tires had scooped out the mud. I ran back through the trees, and that's when I saw her.
Who?
Asked Moss. The mirror girl, said Marion. I saw the yellow of her shirt at first, just like mine. And then I realized I was looking at someone tied to a tree, just like I'd been. The same white tree. I came closer and saw her hair hanging, wet. I circled the tree to come up on her from the front so I wouldn't scare her. And when she saw me, she said, I remember you. And I told her, I remember you too.
You were children the last time you saw each other, said Moss.
I wanted to help her get free, and so I told her to pull out her wrists like I had done. And she pulled but couldn't get free. I tried to help her, but she wasn't tied up with twine. Her wrists were tied up with wire. Her hands and arms were bloody. They were real bad. She'd been trying to pull free but couldn't do it. And the wire wouldn't break. It wasn't loose at all. I tried to help but caused her so much pain when I pulled. I didn't know what to do, so I stayed a little while with her.
You had to leave her, said Moss.
I was worse off than she was because of the river, said Marion. I was so cold. I was turning to ice. I was wet, shivering so much. She told me to get help. She told me she'd be all right, that her dad would be coming for her, that her dad would know where to find her.
And so you tried to find help.
I don't remember what happened after I left her. I thought I was dying. My memory's just gone. I just woke up here, in the hospital. She might still be out there. She's still out there.
We'll find her, said Moss, thinking. One Marion here, another in the Ryder truck. Marion? Why would someone want to attack your family? She asked. Can you think of anyone who would want to do this to you? And why? Anyone that was upset with your dad?
It's sick, she said. I don't know who would do something like this.
Any old Navy buddies? Anything like that? She asked, already knowing who might have killed her father. Hild Kruger. Cobb, but wanting to hear Marion say the names. Victims of violent crimes often knew who the perpetrators were and why the crimes had occurred. Had your father been in touch with anyone?
You have to understand that my dad was different, said Marion. He had thoughts that intruded on him. He said he was recruited for some Navy program. Mom never liked him to talk about this stuff with us. But he couldn't help it sometimes. Like it all just came rushing out of him. He said, he told my mom that the Navy had recruited him to build a ship made of fingernails. I know that sounds crazy, like I'm not remembering right, but that's the way it was. He said the ship will sail carrying the bodies of the dead.
What does that mean, Marion?
I don't know. My dad spent a lot of time away from home, said Marion. He spent time with his friend Fleece. They'd drink together. And his lawyer. He saw her a lot.
Who was his lawyer?
Why did he need a lawyer? Asked Moss. I just heard my parents talking a few times after I'd gone to bed, she said. He was drawing up contracts for something. Needed a lawyer's help. My mom asked if the lawyer would be able to help with our move, but my dad didn't want to drag her into everything.
You were moving? Asked Moss. Do you know why?
I wanted to finish high school, to graduate with my friends. But she said we were leaving, just as soon as my dad was ready. Mom didn't know when that would be. Maybe after graduation, or maybe next week. They wouldn't even tell me where we were moving. But I heard them talk about Arizona a few times.
Think of everyone that your father spent time with, said Moss. Is there anybody that I should know about? You mentioned a family lawyer. Do you think your dad's lawyer is involved somehow? Marion furrowed her eyebrows. She said,
I don't think so. I can't think of why. Although there was something.
But she stopped herself. Let me know, said Moss. It doesn't matter if you're wrong or right, but I want you to fill me in so I can follow up on everything.
My dad was cheating on my mom, said Marion. I don't think she knew, but I figured it out. Figured out something was going on. I heard him on the phone this one time.
Nicole. Do you know who he had a relationship with? Asked Moss, but Marion shook her head. You heard him on the phone.
He was using a pager, always taking calls in private. And I knew what that meant. I had an idea, said Marion. My mom must have looked past it, let herself be lied to. But there was this one morning a few weeks ago. I heard him fighting with someone on the phone. Someone was threatening him. I heard him say, don't tell him. And I thought he meant this woman's husband or boyfriend. I want to see you. Don't tell him. Not yet. And he hung up. Once he left the room, I hit star 69, and a woman's voice answered. I just hung up.
Who do you think this woman was going to tell? Someone your dad knew?
I guess so, said Marion. Yeah, it sounded like he knew him.
If I say someone's name, would you recognize it?
I can try.
Charles Cobb? Asked Moss. Jared Betak?
I don't know, said Marion. I don't think so.
Carl Heildkruger? Asked Moss.
Yes. My dad mentioned him, said Marion,
her eyes haunted as if a ghost walked among them.
My dad was scared of that man. He used to talk about him sometimes. My dad called him the devil. He sometimes said the devil could eat people with his eyes.
Hospital corridors were unnerving spaces. Blank corridors, turns, further corridors. Fluorescent glare on glossy floors. Innumerable doors. What would have happened had we never found the Ryder truck? Moss wondered. Jared Betak and Charles Cobb would have disposed of Marion's body. Where? In the mass grave. In the mound at the house in Buchanan. And this Marion? Hikers would have found her where she died in the woods. Moss imagined this young woman's life. The bewildered grief and insomnia, the late-night television, cyclic news of friends mourning her death even though she was alive. Marion would be alone tonight. She would be alone every night for the rest of her life.
What's going on, Shannon?
Brock asked when Moss had returned to the hospital boardroom. Moss closed the door behind her, poured herself a cup of coffee from the plastic decanter. Powdered cream, sugar, stirring with a red plastic straw.
Fleece had taken Marion, had driven her to the woods. He had shown her the end of time, had tied her to the Vardagr tree. An echoing. One Marion tied with wire, the other Marion tied with twine. One Marion found dead in a Ryder truck, the other Marion found alive.
It's scary what they can... You see that Lamb Dolly on the news, and you think how terrifying it really is, the age we live in, said Brock. Impossible things. That lamb should be an impossibility, but everyone just accepts it. We doubt the existence of miracles, but when they happen, we treat them like they happen every day. Clinton signed that ban just last week. I saw on the news. President Clinton banned human cloning, but I'm realizing now what's going on here.
That's not what's going on here, said Moss. Let her sleep tonight, if she can sleep. But guard the room. Her life is still in danger, I think, if anyone learns that she's here. No one can talk about this, Brock. What we've seen? I think we should push for Witsec if we can. At least we should move her from here, and soon. Moss tarried after Brock left, alone in the half-light of the closed cafeteria with her thoughts, drinking coffee and eating vanilla Oreos from the vending machine, until Dr. Schroeder informed her that Marion had finally accepted a sedative, had fallen asleep. There were three special agents who would spell one another through the night, guarding Marion's room. Before he left, Brock had told Moss he would broach the subject of witness protection with his supervisor, coordinate with NCIS and the U.S. Marshals. He would call Marion's aunt and uncle. He would figure out a way to tell them that one of the children they'd buried had lived. Moss filled napkins with a blue ballpoint pen, at first just lines and shading until her thoughts untangled. A place in the woods. The Vardagr, she wrote. Then wrote the word a second time, and wrote, one with wire, one with twine. 10 agents could travel to 10 ifs and report back different details from each. Existence was a matter of chance, of probability, as infinite futures became one observed present. Life and death often hung on details. In one existence, Marion's wrists had been tied with wire. But in another, her wrists had been tied with twine. How had she echoed, Moss wrote, the mirror girl, and lost herself in thought. She shredded her notes and called O'Connor before she left the hospital, after midnight, but he was awake. He had seen the reports coming out of Buchanan and had already spoken with his counterpart in the FBI. But the news concerning Marion's echoing stunned him, and by the end of their conversation, he'd promised that he and another special agent would arrive in Clarksburg by the following day.
"What's your next move?"
he had asked.
"We have to find the Vardagr."
Nearing 1 a.m. when Moss left Preston Memorial, an hour's drive home. The country roads she drove were twisting paths obscured by trees, pitch black. But occasionally, the view ahead cleared and she saw the moon and fiery pinpoints of stars and the silver of Halebop, its streaking tail like flowing locks of a woman's hair. She remembered the enclosing pines here, the canopy choking out light. But that had been with Nestor, years from now, when she'd been anxious over seeing the place where Marion's bones were found. This morning, though, the Canaan Mountain bore little resemblance to her memories of the place. The approach, serene glades and sods, spruce, balsam fir, hemlock doused in buttery sunlight. Rangers had marked the access route with an orange ribbon. She came to the clearing where the incline leveled and found O'Connor's Subaru already nestled beneath an overhang of branches. Only a short hike from here. The path was cleaner than she remembered, after what would be 20 years of growth, when Nestor had pulled back branches for her, when he had stomped down weeds in her way. Much easier to find her footing now. A thin path, simple to follow. She wore hiking boots this time, which helped, and made it to the dried runnel where just yesterday morning Brock had found Marion alive.
"Shannon! Over here!"
Two men, a little ways off. O'Connor had driven overnight from D.C. to meet Marion for himself, and to see this place in the woods, the Vardager. An avid outdoorsman, he looked like an Edwardian painting of a gentleman hunter this morning, with a walking stick and rubber galoshes that reached to his knees. Moss would have recognized O'Connor's partner by his height and bulk alone, she was sure. But otherwise, the man bore little resemblance to the sage she had once met. Najoku was shaven bald, his beard a chiseled black strip. Golden hoops dangled from each of his earlobes. He smiled as O'Connor introduced him, was pleasantly bewildered when Moss said, "We were well met once before, Dr. Najoku."
"I asked Najoku to Red Eye from Boston because of the developments with Marion," said O'Connor. "He has experience with echoes, and his work at MIT focuses on thin spaces.
Collapsibility of Everett Space and Brant LaMonaco's space-time knots," said Najoku.
"It's a pleasure to meet you, Shannon. Or, I should say it's a pleasure to meet you again for the first time."
She was delighted to see this man with years peeled from him. But Moss remembered there was a woman whose fingers made beautiful sounds on saxophone keys. She remembered when Najoku was to have met this woman. "Wally, you should be in Boston right now," she said. "There is someone you were supposed to meet." Doubt fluttered over his face, the shadow of a falling leaf. But soon he smiled.
"There are many paths," he said.
O'Connor trudged ahead, pulling through long strides with his walking stick. Moss kept an easier pace with Najoku. "Have you ever seen a falling star as it blooms?" Easy to imagine Najoku lingering in a neighbor's garden, philosophizing over the beauty of flowers. He paused frequently here in the woods, allowing Moss to catch up with him, running his fingers over the flesh of a petal, or crouching low to inspect an insect or a mark on a spider's funnel.
"Here's a cairn,"
said O'Connor ahead. The spot was marked by powdery orange spray paint, a cross on the ground that would wash away with the first rain. The cairn was what she imagined it would be, though more carefully constructed. It was a pyramidal stack of flat river stones, a foot and a half high. The cairn was balanced on a fallen log, barnacled by plump fungus and carpeted with moss.
"The FBI found 4 so far," said O'Connor. "2 are on the far side of the river."
"I thought the cairns would have marked the location of Marion's body," said Moss. "I thought they would lead the way to the burial site."
"The cairns mark the location of Marion's Vardager tree," said O'Connor.
"Look at this," said Najoku.
He folded open a pocket notebook and showed Moss several pages of inky dots he'd connected with sketchy lines into various shapes, several pointed stars.
"The cairns are equidistant," he said. "If you imagine each cairn as a point..."
"We found a burnt tree at the center of the star," said O'Connor.
"I want to see it," she said. Blueberry thickets, burrs and thistles that clung to Moss's sock, a meadow strewn with flat-top boulders, the rush of a river as they neared the Vardager, a swift sound, as if the forest whispered where she should walk.
"When O'Connor called about Marion, I thought her Vardager might be something we call a thin space," said Najoku. "The Naval Research Lab calls them Brant LaMonaco space-time knots."
"I've heard that term before," said Moss. "We talked about them in training. BL knots, the residue of quantum foam."
"You're exactly right. Residue, almost like pollution."
"The BL drives affect space-time," said Najoku. "Knots are locations where an infinite-density singularity event breaks down effects of quantum gravity, allowing superposition. Wave function collapse sometimes doesn't occur. Simultaneous Everett spaces..."
"Whoa, you're losing me," said Moss.
"Echoes," he said. "Here we are. Here is the tree we found."
The husk of a pine, a stark white tower of ash surrounded by verdant evergreens. "Yes," said Moss, recognizing this ashen tree. "Here we are." Lost in the terminus when she had last seen this tree, she'd been confused by it then. It had seemed to repeat, recursively, like a mirror image of a mirror. She had searched for the tree in the years since,
but hadn't been able to find it, and had grown to think of it as a mistake of memory, a hallucination. Seeing it now was a relief, a confirmation. There was nothing fearsome about this place, however, not with Najoku here, and O'Connor, the noon sun almost too warm for her jacket. Nothing fearsome, but still unnatural. The Vardagr was burnt, but not burned away. Moss had seen scorched woods before, the remains of forest fires, carpets of ash, charred trunks branchless and sooty like lines of spent matchsticks. The Vardagr looked preserved by fire, rather than consumed. The trunk was barked with crackled ash, so light gray it seemed luminous white. But when Moss touched the trunk, it felt more like petrified wood than seared wood. She touched the branches and was startled to find they felt as smooth and as brittle as glass. She was nearer the rush of the river now.
"I'll be back,"
she said, leaving Najoku and O'Connor at the Vardagr. She hurried toward the sound of water and came through the tree line, emerging onto an outcropping of boulders. The Red Run was a turbulent set of rapids before her, twisting drops, white water crashing through gaps in the jagged stones. Where the river was calmer, the water was the color of tea, dyed by the tannin of the surrounding hemlocks. Moss recognized the future of this place. It was the winter of the terminus then, and instead of the goldenrod and willows and bushes of flowering mountain laurel along the banks, there had been pinions of ice that had seemed to impale her in the air. This is where she'd been crucified. Her reflection had been here, an echo. Moss glanced back toward the tree line, half expecting a woman in orange to reach for her, beseeching her. But there was no one.
"I've been here," said Moss, returning to Najoku and O'Connor. "This is the place where I had my accident," she said. "I'm sure of it. I saw another version of myself here. I saw my echo."
"Thin spaces are unpredictable, unstable. Sometimes they're inert, but sometimes they're spooky as hell," said Najoku. "Reflections, echoes, closed time-like curves." "Wally's explanations sometimes assume a PhD-level understanding of quantum mechanics," said O'Connor. "Maybe he can slow it down for us."
"I understand echoing," said Moss. "But this whole place should repeat." Aware she wasn't sure exactly how to describe her experience with this place. This was the same white tree, the same area of pines, the same river as she remembered, she was sure of it. But it was off somehow, as if she were looking at a stage set of a place she remembered rather than the place itself. "It was like I could see 100 of these trees, thousands in every way I looked, in every direction, like the world receded from me." But she was interrupted by what first felt like the onset of a seizure or a stroke, some swift mental aberration, or a fault in her eyes as the forest changed around them. The pines were denser, the growth heavier. Najoku pushed through the branches, Moss and O'Connor following, and they came to the clearing, the Red Run. But they seemed to be on the wrong side of the river. The white Vardagr tree was visible on the far side, rather than behind them.
"Over there," said Najoku. "We got turned around somehow. We have to cross."
Moss held them back. They trekked back the way they had come and passed the white tree. They tried to find the dry creek bed, to follow it back to their cars, but they were lost and passed the white tree again, Najoku chuckling in frustration. They broke through the surrounding pines and returned to the white tree. After a moment, the sensation passed. They were again in the recognizable woods near a single white tree, as though the denser pines and repeating woods had only been a trick of the eye. Najoku's laughter was like the clarion pealing of a bell.
"Like I said, spooky as hell." "Let's go, away from here," said O'Connor, leaning on his walking stick,
dizzy or untrusting of the earth.
"We shouldn't be here."
Closer to what she remembered of her experience with this place, the disorientation, the repetition, Moss was eager to distance herself from it, and she hurried on ahead, almost running, her heart pumping fear of this place.